lovely sounds of Bill Evans, just one of the many musicians photographed by Kathy Sloan at Keystone Corner, a San Francisco jazz club. Keystone closed its doors in the early 80s, and there's not been a club like it since. Sloan, who truly honed her art and craft as a photographer in the dim light and raw energy of Keystone Corner, has brought her photographs of the jazz musicians who played there, along with recollections of many of the folks who were part of the scene there, into her recently published Keystone Corner, A Portrait of a Jazz Club. I'm Suzanne Lang, and it's Jazz Connections here on KRCB's A Novel Idea. Jazz historian and Sonoma County's own jazz MD, Larry Slater, talks with Sloan about her days at Keystone, her life as a photographer, and the making of this beautiful book. The book comes with music from the Keystone sessions, and we'll be enjoying that throughout the broadcast. In the second half of the show, jazz musician and music publisher and longtime host of KRCB's Jazz Connections brings us his conversation with philosopher Jacob Needleman on his latest book, An Unknown World, Notes on the Meaning of the Earth. And Barbara Quick is back with her review of Cheryl Strayed's best-selling memoir, Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail. So stay with us. It's a novel idea.
Good evening. I'm Larry Slater, Sonoma County's Jazz MD. And my guest is Kathy Sloan, a Bay Area photographer who has just published a book titled Keystone Corner, Portrait of a Jazz Club. I spent many a joyful hour at Keystone, so I was delighted to find Kathy's book that so vividly brings the psychedelic jazz club to life. Kathy, welcome to KRCB and Sonoma County, which has its own thriving jazz scene.
Thank you, Larry. It's really nice to be here today. It's a beautiful day.
Kathy, tell us a little bit about Keystone Corner, the jazz club in North Beach that's the focus of your book.
Well, Keystone Corner was really a little hole in the wall. It was pretty small. People, when it was full, were jammed in on long tables that were kind of like on sawhorses with bent wood chairs to sit in, which were remarkably uncomfortable. But the buzz in there was always very high. There was a lot of energy. The waitresses had a hard row to hoe because they'd have to, you know, kind of shimmy in and hand drinks down the tables. It had a small stage, but could hold a big band. And I haven't found a club since that I like as much.
Yeah, I remember going to Keystone. I was a patron at the time. And what I remember is being incredibly uncomfortable, the room being completely full of cigarette smoke, right, and nothing starting within an hour of its designated time.
Oh, that sometimes happened. But it was also what made it such a wonderful place for musicians, because it was not a corporate jazz club.
Exactly. When Yoshi's opened, I felt like, this isn't a jazz club. It's way too comfortable.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, Keystone was what it was. I mean, it had the greatest music. Mm-hmm. It had the greatest musicians.
It did.
And it did have a special vibe. It just wasn't comfortable.
No, it wasn't comfortable, and everybody talks about that. The other thing, though, about it was that it had the greatest musicians, and it had a very eclectic palette of musicians. So even though Todd really was a bebop man in his heart.
Todd Barkin, the owner of the club.
Exactly, sorry. There were musicians across the spectrum, and that made it really interesting.
Yeah, I've talked to people who went to Keystone in its heyday, and they would say they often wouldn't even look to see who was on the marquee. They would just know that it was going to be interesting and it was going to be good music and it would expand their horizons, and they would just go to listen.
Right.
Kathy, tell us a little bit about you. How did you choose to become a photographer, and why jazz as your focus?
Well, I chose to become a photographer because I had a daughter who was a severe asthmatic, and I was a teacher. And I had moved to the Bay Area from New York, and I was teaching high school dropouts. I was teaching returning Vietnam vets at San Francisco State who wanted to go to school full-time and needed to brush up. But I was missing a lot of work because of my daughter. And I moved next door to some people who had a dark room and nowhere to put it. And I had an extra bedroom that really needed a roommate to help pay the rent. But I opted for the dark room, and I had been doing a little bit of photography, and people kept saying, you know, you should pursue this. You have a good eye. So I taught myself photography, and I had a friend who was a musician, Bob Bray, who was a drummer, who took me to Keystone for the first time in 1976. And as soon as I walked into the room, I heard the civil rights movement, and I had been involved as a teacher. And I thought, ah, this is the sound of what that freedom movement was about. I want to take pictures of the musicians.
You talk in the book a little bit about how difficult it was to work at Keystone because the lighting was crummy and it was crowded and there wasn't really room for you to move around. What kind of a reception did you get from Todd Barkin and from the musicians?
Bob Bray introduced me to Todd the second time we went there, which was, I remember, to hear Elvin Jones. And Bob was a pretty assertive character, and he said, you should just let her come here and photograph and not charge her. And Todd said, okay, all you have to do is give me a print of the musicians you photograph every time you come. And that worked for me. Because they had a kitchen, children could come, so I could bring my daughter, and she would sleep in the back room, or she'd stand up front with the ticket people and help take tickets, and she was very welcomed. The musicians, I approached each time a new musician came to town and asked permission to make photographs, and I think they were so startled that they were being asked that nobody ever said no. So I would come back. I would go on Tuesday when they opened, and I would listen because I can't listen and photograph at the same time. That's two different kinds of focus, so to speak. So I would listen. I'd come on Thursday and photograph, and on Sunday I would return with a print for each of the musicians and one for Todd. So I didn't, you know, I didn't want to rip off the musicians. I knew that history.
That's a great story. Did you have any jazz photography role models? Were you aware of William Claxton or William Gottlieb or Herman Leonard, the people who'd really made a name for themselves as jazz photographers?
I really had not a clue.
Huh.
I was just beginning to photograph. That's where I learned how to photograph, in the dark with, as you said, terrible lighting. And so it was like my school. I learned what light did on film and how I might have thought that a musician in a spotlight with a hat on his head, I could see his face. Well, when I looked at the film, his face was gone because the hat was shading it. So I learned all of that there. And I was more interested in discovering this art form myself and didn't look at jazz photographers until many years later. However, I had looked at other photographers. One of my favorites was W. Eugene Smith, who you might be interested in, Larry, because he did a wonderful photo essay for Life magazine on the country doctor. And I also came to adore Roy DiCarava, also a magnificent photographer, and then later on learned about the others. There's a book, by the way, that came out at the same time mine did, about the confluence of jazz and photography, and it's called Blue Notes in Black and White. And it's by a man named Ben Cawthra, C-A-W-T-H-R-A. It's a brilliant look at jazz photography in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and how the jazz and photography grew together through places like Life magazine.
There is something about jazz that makes it photogenic. I've never quite figured what that is. In the old days, it was always the cigarette smoke, right?
Right.
Framed by the horn or by the vocalist.
I think it's the passion and the intensity mm-hmm. of the look of musicians, because actually that's the only art form where there's no eraser. You know, you can't undo what you just played. It's all improvisational. And I was very taken with that idea, that somebody could stand up there and create on the spot, in the moment.
That's what makes it jazz.
That's what makes it jazz.
Keystone operated from 1972, I believe, when Todd Barkin bought the club and then closed in 1983. So I was surprised to see your book all these many years later about this club that was such a part of the Bay Area scene at the time. Why now? What was the genesis of the idea?
Well, part of the genesis of the idea was that I had continued to be a freelance photographer since then. And I decided not to make jazz as a way of making a living. So I had gone on and I had done almost entirely work that came out of nonprofit organizations hiring me. And I have a wonderful archive of Bay Area life, schools, community centers, hospitals. I did a lot in Children's Hospital. In those days, you could go take pictures there. Now, they won't even let you in the door with a camera. So it became time for me when I did this. I started it in 2005 to be an archaeologist in my archives and start bringing together bodies of work. And somebody said to me, why don't you do a book of jazz photographs? I said, there are a lot of books of jazz photographs. I need something, a hook. And he said to me, well, what about Keystone Corner? And this light bulb went off. And I keep very good records. So I went back and I pulled all my Keystone negatives and I proof sheets and I looked through them three times and I picked out the best ones. When I looked at them, I said, okay, this is fine, but the story is not full enough just with pictures. And I knew that I wanted Al Young to write the introduction, but really I wanted him to write the text. And I approached him because I know him. And he had just become Poet Laureate of California, and he said, no way I can do this now. So I said, okay, maybe I should go interview people who were involved with the club. And that's how that part came. So I started out, my first interview was Eddie Marshall, who I had kept in touch with all these years. And I went to his house and I interviewed him, and Laurie Antonioli just happened to be there, so I interviewed her. And then I developed a list of people that I knew would talk to me, and then they also suggested other people.
And what I really loved about the book is that not only do you have musician interviews, but there's interviews with the sound guy and the cook and the bouncer. How did you find all those people?
Okay, how did I find them? The Aura Harris, who was the cook, I had lost touch with her, but Terry Hinty, I believe. Yes, Terry Hinty put me in touch with her. Terry Hinty also suggested the guy who was the sound guy. And he, at that point, was the archivist for Fantasy Records, which had the archives of Keystone. So I had him. Devorah Major was also a Poet Laureate of San Francisco. I had known her since she was a child. Her father and I were very good friends. So I wanted this cross-section. I didn't want just musicians. In terms of musicians, what I would do was, for the ones I didn't know well, when they came to town to play, I would call the club or the hotel and see if they would do an interview with me. I wanted to do Ron Carter, for instance, but he didn't return my phone call. But other people, Eddie Henderson, who I'd known back in the day, but he was now in New York, he agreed to meet me when he was playing at Yoshi's. Dave Liebman and I met in a restaurant near Yoshi's. Let me just say that there are four people in the book who each have their own chapters. And they have their own chapters because they were good talkers. And I thought what they had to say was interesting. Jack Hirschman had also been a poet laureate in San Francisco. And he had been dating one of the waitresses at Keystone when we were there. and I knew him from then, although I would see him occasionally after that. And he met me outside the Cafe Trieste in San Francisco, which for those people in San Francisco know it's on an incredibly busy corner. And I had at that point I had an old tape recorder. And we set it out on the street. And, of course, everybody who walked by had to stop and talk to Jack. So it was a very noisy background, but luckily it's only being transcribed. And Jack is a poet. And Jack had spent a lot of time at Keystone and had wonderful connections to make between art and the music and how jazz had inflected his writing. And so he got a chapter. Aura Harris, who was a cook there, also was a wonderful storyteller. And she had met Todd through Rahsaan. And, you know, Rahsaan was Todd's inspiration.
Rahsaan Roland Kirk.
Right. And then, of course, Todd had his own chapter because it was his club, Todd Barkin. And he had, you know, the history to tell of how it came to be and how he thought about it and the problems he had. He had all of that. So they each had their own chapter. And then Orrin Keepnews is a very well-known producer of jazz records, and he goes back to New York days.
Yeah, Orrin was the original owner of Riverside.
Exactly.
Those Sonny Rollins and Thelonious Monk records.
Exactly. So he was very generous. He came to my studio and we talked for a long time. And then I had all these interviews and I still didn't have a shape to the book. I didn't have any budget. Nobody was coming to me with sacks full of money and saying, let me help you. I didn't have a publisher yet. And so I had to do the transcribing, which turned out to be a blessing in disguise because as I was listening and writing, certain themes seemed to rise up to the top, like, you know, when you used to buy bottles of milk with cream on top, showing my age. There they were. And I said, oh, I could do this by making it like a conversation between people who are not in the same room. And we could talk about different themes. So it all fell into mm-hmm. place, and I was able to move paragraphs around, keeping the voice. Keeping the voice was the most interesting and the most challenging part, so everybody didn't sound flattened out. So that's how the book came to be. And then Al Young at that point said, okay, I will write a preface to the book, an introduction. But you should get in touch with a man named Sasha Feinstein, who might be interested in publishing a piece of this. Well, Sasha Feinstein is one of the more remarkable human beings in this world, who teaches at a college in the middle of Pennsylvania called Lycoming. And he puts out and had been editing a journal called Brilliant Corners, which is a journal of jazz and literature. So I got in touch with him. I sent him some photographs. He loved them. He said, okay, I want to publish some of these with your introduction to the book. Well, I hadn't written my introduction yet because that, of course, was the hard part. But I spent the summer writing it, and I sent it to him, and he published a section of the book. And I said, would you like to edit this book? And he said, no. That was unequivocal. Thank you, but I have enough to do. But I nagged him for about 8 months, and he finally said yes. And that was a wonderful working relationship. He got what I was doing. He does interviews for his magazine, so he could see how close we were in our aesthetic.
You talked about the musicians were pretty open about giving you interviews. But I did notice that there were some very prominent musicians who played at Keystone who are alive today who are not in the book. And I just have to ask why Wynton Marsalis is not in the book and Pharoah Sanders, who actually lives in Oakland, is not in the book. McCoy Tyner isn't in the book. Why weren't they in the book?
Wynton Marsalis wasn't in the book because there's enough Wynton Marsalis out there in the world, and I really wanted to bring in other people. And that's not to say I don't like Wynton Marsalis. It was just, you know, there's a lot of Wynton Marsalis in the world. I would have loved to have done Pharoah, who I actually do know and had worked with. I don't know if you remember Teresa Records. Teresa Records was a small label in Oakland. that was owned by Alan Pittman and Betty Ishida. And I had done a lot of work with Pharoah because they recorded him. But Pharoah is not a talker. And he plays beautifully, and that's the way he speaks to the world. He's not a talker.
Tell me about the relationship with some of the musicians. Did you get to be friends with some of them?
I did.
I mean, some of the greatest artists of our time were there, Bill Evans and Dexter Gordon and Rahsaan, of course. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your relationship with them.
Okay. I didn't have relationships with them. I had cordial meetings when I was there. They didn't have any problem with me photographing. But I was a bit intimidated by them. You know, I mean, these were really larger than life in my life.
They're the giants.
They're the giants. But when I first met Art Blakey, he was the first musician I met who turned to me and said, "And what do you do other than, you know, take pictures of us?" And I was so taken by that that I immediately invited him to come for dinner. And I lived in a small house in North Oakland. I had, you know, a kitchen table and some chairs and maybe a little couch. But he said yes. And he came to my house. There's a photo at the end of this book of him with my daughter Aisha sitting on his lap playing her violin for him. She was 7 at the time. And we had a wonderful time. And afterwards, he said to me, "You know, you're the only American who ever invited me home for dinner. All over Europe, Asia, people invite you home. You're the first." I don't know that I believed it, but it was part of his sweetness. And one of the things we discovered about each other is that we were both avid readers. And so whenever he'd come to town, we'd talk about what we were reading, what literature we were into. And what he said he wanted to do was take my daughter to his home in Long Island so that I could be in New York where I needed to be to make my art grow. And I said that was very sweet, but no, he couldn't have my daughter. And, you know, we remained friends until the end. He was such a generous human being.
Wow, what a sweet story. And how about Todd? I mean, when you first approached Todd Barkin, mm-hmm. the owner and really the soul of the club, mm-hmm. what was Todd's reaction to you writing a book? And how much input did he want? And did he want editorial control in the book?
Yes and yes and yes. when I first approached him, I called him from here and I was going to New York to interview people. And he said, "Okay." And we made a date to meet at Dizzy's, where he was the artistic director. And he said, "You know, I've been writing my autobiography for 30 years, working on it, and I don't want to give you these stories." And so I said, "Well, I'm not writing a biography of you. I'm writing a biography of the place." And he said, "Well, I don't know. Let me comp you for the night." I said, no, let's talk about this interview. So after a fairly long conversation, he said, "Okay, come back next week and I'll do an interview with you." So we did a great interview. He did a really good interview.
I mean, most people in the book were very complimentary of Todd, but not everybody.
Almost everybody.
Almost everybody.
Eddie Henderson was not.
Eddie Henderson was not. And Orrin Keepnews. Yeah, Orrin Keepnews, again, the fellow who was one of jazz's legendary record producers, compared him to Max Gordon, who was the owner and proprietor of the Village Vanguard. And I think his comment was, "He ain't no Max Gordon."
It's true. And I have to say, though, Orrin was very critical of Todd as a businessman.
Yeah.
But for every sentence he said of Todd being the worst businessman in the world, he said, "But you can't fault his taste and you can't fault the way he treated musicians." So, you know, it was hot and cold. But mostly, and I didn't plan it this way because I didn't know what people would say, I think it was a love song to Todd.
I really enjoyed that chapter. I thought it was one of the most entertaining parts of the book, mostly because he's so outspoken.
So frank,
yes. He is very frank. The book contains a CD.
Yeah.
There were a number of recordings from Keystone. Mm-hmm. Apparently some were planned, some were not. Your book mentions that there was a tape rolling at all times. And some of the recording quality was terrible and some of it was wonderful. But there was always a tape rolling somewhere. And so of the many Keystone recordings that are out, there are variable audio quality. As an amateur jazz historian myself, I loved the back two pages of the book where you listed every single recording from Keystone. I loved that. How did you compile that?
Also, that was a gift too. Stuart Kremski, as I said, was the archivist of Fantasy. And when I went to interview him, he actually offered to do a discography for me.
Do you still have a connection to the jazz world, Kathy? Do you go to hear jazz? Are you photographing jazz musicians today?
I do it occasionally. I don't have the same relationships with any clubs. After Keystone closed, even during Keystone, actually, I had a good relationship with Tom Bradshaw at Great American Music Hall. He also let me come in and photograph. I did some at Yoshi's, but it was too big and I was too far away. And I, as you can tell from my photographs, I like to be in the music. Now, if I go to Yoshi's and a friend of mine is playing there, I don't know, let's say Oliver Lake is playing there, and I go to go backstage to say hello, there's some guy in a suit who greets me at the door, and he says, "You can't go in, and I don't know you." And
it's a different world.
It's a very different world.
One last comment. This is a photography question, Kathy. To me, the black and white photographs speak to me, and the color photographs do not.
Me too. Color is so seductive that if you have color, then the forms and the shapes and the faces get subsumed by the color. And so I shot in black and white, except for clients who insisted on color, until I went digital. And that now I will shoot in color and transform it to black and white. I much prefer black and white.
I feel the same way. Kathy, if you could go in your time machine and you could go back to Keystone, is there a particular artist or event or gig that you would want to sit in on that you missed?
Yeah, I would like to have sat in on Miles Davis, which I missed. He played there before I got there. There's one night that I was there that was pretty spectacular. Arthur Blythe was playing with tuba player Bob Stewart, and I had met Bob earlier, and the day of the concert, I took him up north to Bodega Bay and driving back. And when we got back, I played him a very favorite recording of mine, which is Archie Shepp and Horace Parlan playing gospel music. And, you know, then I took him back to the club and I went that night to hear him. And I walked in the club and they were playing all the way out. I mean, they were in the stratosphere. And I stood in the door for a minute because I didn't want to break that. And as I was standing there, Bob played a solo of Motherless Child, which I had played for him that afternoon. And I guess he saw me come in because, you know, it was pretty dark. I just stood there and I wept at this hello. It was a hello.
Wow.
Yeah, I would go back to that. Horace Silver, I took my father to hear Horace Silver while my father was still alive. And Horace played Song for My Father. I'd go back to that one with my father with me.
Well, Kathy, thank you so much. This
thank
has just
you.
Been a real treat for
what
me.
What a nice interview. Thank you so much, Larry.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Larry Slater, Sonoma County's Jazz MD, and Kathy Sloan, photographer and author of Keystone Corner, A Portrait of a Jazz Club. Visit Kathy's website, kathysloanphotographer.com, where you can explore more of her photographic work. Larry Slater opens up the music of Keystone in his 4-hour Jazz Connection special, which you can hear on Saturday, December 29th, from 8 to midnight on KRCB. and streaming at krcb.org. Let's take a short break with a little Dexter Gordon recorded at Keystone Corner in San Francisco, California. We'll be right back with Chuck Scherer, Jacob Needleman, and Barbara Quick. Stay with us. You're listening to A Novel Idea on KRCB, and I'm Suzanne Lang. Coming up next is my conversation with jazz musician Chuck Scherer, and then Chuck's conversation with philosopher Jacob Needleman on his latest publication, An Unknown World. Later in the broadcast, author Barbara Quick brings her review of Cheryl Strayed's memoir, Wild. I'm here with Chuck Scherer. He is the regular host of KRCB's Jazz Connections. Welcome, Chuck.
Welcome to you, too, and thanks.
And listeners can hear you and the beautiful music you bring to us. Generally, it's the first Saturday of the month on KRCB.
Yes, at 8 p.m. till midnight.
But today, we're having the pleasure to talk about a book, and we will be hearing from the author himself, Jacob Needleman, and he's just released a book called An Unknown World, Notes on the Meaning of the Earth. And Chuck is the one who brought this book to my attention, so I wanted to talk with you a little bit about it, Chuck.
It would be my pleasure.
Maybe you could give the listeners a little flavor of maybe some of the text from the book or set the book up a little bit.
Yeah, for those of you who are not familiar with Dr. Needleman, he's a philosophy professor at San Francisco State, professor of philosophy and religion. And he's also the author of 20-some books and innumerable articles. He's a real intellectual, and yet he's more than that. I've had the pleasure to hang out with him numerous occasions the last few years, and he's an extraordinary person, really brilliant mentally, but that's only the beginning of his powers. He's really an extraordinary person. And it comes through in his writing. This book in particular seems really heartfelt to me. All of his books have a certain hallmark to them, which is that they take philosophical ideas and he shows how they actually have some real-life effect on him and his students. And that's sort of the signature of his writing in general. And this book is even more that way. It's so personal. And through his own personal experiences, it makes the ideas that he's discussing come alive. It's really extraordinary writing.
He is an academic, yet he infuses his work with this very personal exploration that he himself is on.
Yes, he certainly is.
And so it's not from a point of distance that he writes.
Right. Nothing theoretical about it.
Yes.
You know, in this particular book, it starts with him being really almost obsessed with a certain idea of what's the function of our lives, what's the function of man's life on Earth, and what's the function of the Earth and the cosmos? Why are we here? What's the point of having this elaborate machinery? And as he rolls these questions around, there was a series of dreams that occurred to him that were just astounding, frankly, of his childhood best friend who died when he was 14 years old of leukemia. And this person, Elias, comes to him in a series of dreams that these questions of what are we here for get intertwined with the astounding experiences he had in these dreams. At one point, he says these thoughts that he had about the earth were sitting next to him like a pile of stones. And right there, there's an astounding thing of having your thoughts be completely separate from you. And then Elias told him that he should put them back in his body. Let me read you one thing on that same subject. Humanity's relationship to the earth mirrors our own essential relationship to our own physical body. Who is it that lives on and in this personal earth, this human body that I call mine? What quality of attention do I give to it? And in those moments when life becomes infinitely more real, when I become infinitely more present, when I become real, when time transforms, is it true that there comes into being an entirely new relationship to the body? Perhaps it's truer to say an entirely new body emerges for a moment from behind the shadows of my tensions and anxieties.
It is a beautiful examination of corporeality in a way, and I think sometimes we so take for granted our physicality, even when we are, say, obsessed with being physical, but maybe not exploring or comprehending the nature of this structure and organism that we reside in.
Yeah, well, I think it was T.S. Eliot, one of his poems, said that Mr. Jones lived a short distance from his body, you know. Which, I seems like exactly the way things are until one has the inspiration and the chance to actually come into your own existence, both physically and mentally and emotionally, where you're actually present. And, you know, of course, all spiritual traditions are headed in that direction. And yoga, for example, or Tai Chi give you that real sense of living in your body. The Gurdjieff work is like that too. There's a lot of internal exploration that is required in order to take our normal functioning and actually bring out the possibilities that we have inside of us. And that's really the bottom line focus of An Unknown World. Dr. Needleman is convinced from personal experience that we are capable of much more than we normally sense and perceive and feel, that our job is to heighten that, to make our time here to be of utmost value to our own internal development. And that's what the book is heading toward. But it's so beautifully put.
In the book, is he making these sorts of observations, or does he really encourage a practice or strategy for achieving that?
And that's really not the function of the book. He's trying to get people, it's my own take on it, trying to get people to at least come to the place where they realize that their lives are not completely meaningless. And then after that, you'd have to do some research on your own to figure out how you were going to make your life of some value other than your immediate pleasures. But that's the direction that he thinks not only we have to do for ourselves, but for the earth itself, which to me is a pretty astounding idea. And, you know, that the idea that the earth is alive, Gaia, that it actually is its own life, its own organism, is not a new idea. And Dr. Needleman didn't make that up, but he certainly makes that idea come alive in this book, where he gives you the feeling that, you know, our life here and our consciousness is not accidental, that the earth has brought us forth out of itself in order to serve this cosmic function.
We separate ourselves from nature, and that separation from nature in some ways separates us from who we are.
I would agree with that. The hubris that it's our job to have dominion over the earth. I can see where in a hunter-gatherer society that might have seemed like a good idea. But a couple thousand years later, we can see the results of that, which is that we're bringing the earth to its knees here. And the solution that Dr. Needleman proposes, in addition to whatever efforts you might make in the external world, his contention, I believe, would be that the root cause of the external problems that we are having, global warming and pollution and all that, that that's an external manifestation of internal diminishment of our collective self, and that in order to repair that, we have to start at the root, which is our own lack of internal solidity, where the forces at work on us individually and even worse collectively create massive problems, because we're basically just being thrown about by all of our whims and wishes. And I know as a parent, it's clear that, you know, you watch your kids grow up and there's all these forces that are working on them, right? And they think that they're being cool or that they're being themselves, when actually they're just acting out these roles that are being subscribed for them. And all of us are in the same boat, really. And to get past that requires effort to find out who you really are outside of the forces that are operating on you.
And it seems that fear might be at the base of a lot of that.
I'm sure.
Fear of nature, I think, is also something that drives us. We fear weather, for instance. And over these thousands and thousands and thousands of years, we've built these not only stone buildings to protect us from what's outside, but in some ways we've done that internally mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah, it's a mirror of the other.
Yeah.
That's right.
Anything else you want to leave us with as an inspiration, or what moved you further in the book?
Well, let me see if I can find something here. Yeah. Let me just read one more small quote from An Unknown World. He says, "How then to become a genuine self? This situation of man is not something to be repaired. It's not exactly a problem to be solved. It's a state of consciousness to be lived. I could not solve it with my mind, and yet my mind was now glowing with a calm light."
Well, I'm glad to see him come out with this book. It seemed that his last book, What is God? And I want to mention some of his other works, The Essential Marcus Aurelius. Have you read much of his other books, by the way?
Three or four.
Okay. Yeah. Why Can't We Be Good?
That's a great book.
Introduction to the Gurdjieff work, The American Soul, Two Dreams of America, The Wisdom of Love, Time and the Soul, Money and the Meaning of Life. And just from those titles, you can see what he is continuing to explore, and that we're benefiting from his encouragement through his work.
I certainly have. I would encourage people to read An Unknown World. It's an astounding book. You know, we're only on the planet for a short time. Might as well make good use of it. That's what I think.
Thanks a lot, Chuck.
Thank you.
Now let's listen to Chuck Scherer's conversation with philosopher Jacob Needleman.
It seems to me that one of the hallmarks of your writing over the years has been an attempt to make philosophy understandable to the layperson by your using your own personal story of how these ideas took root inside of you. And this book in particular, An Unknown World, seems to me to be the culmination of that approach, where you show the personal urgency that you felt about the condition of our planet.
I feel that philosophy deals with questions not just of the mind, but of the heart. And I want to write in a way, I hope to try to write in a way that people will feel as well as think about the ideas I'm presenting. And therefore, I often use stories from my personal life where I personally encountered an idea or an issue, and how it made me understand something through my deeper feelings as well as intellectually. So that's been my hope of my writings for years and years. And of course, this book maybe went even more deeply into that way of writing philosophy.
And your sense of concern that comes out of this book of the urgency of the question of the crises that's facing humanity and our whole planet. Is that a recent thing in your own awareness?
It was at the edge of my thinking for years, but it only crystallized when I suddenly almost got the form of a vision having to do with my childhood friend, who was a friend whom we always talked together about questions about nature and God and life and the human mind. And it came sort of like a visitation from him and made me feel that, yes, the problem, the question, the crisis of Earth is interwoven intimately with the crisis of our human, own individual human development in this culture. In some way, the book tries to show is that we cannot solve the problem of the Earth unless there's a spiritual solution to our own metaphysical hunger and need. And of course, we can't understand the Earth without understanding ourselves intimately, because everything in the ecosystem has a function and a purpose on this planet. Humanity did not arise, in my opinion, and in the opinion of a great many of the wisdom teachings, humanity did not arise just accidentally through some mutations by chance, but it's come onto the Earth for a purpose, a reason that is uniquely human, in that the Earth needs our human consciousness to exist on Earth in a way that is, as corresponds to what we are meant to be inwardly. And to put it simply, the Earth needs not only for us to fix environmentally the mess we have created, but it needs us for its own survival to develop inwardly, to come to our full state of consciousness that we are born for. So yes, that was came to me quite recently, and inescapably, actually.
You know, somewhere in the book you mention, let me just read a sentence here. It says, "The Earth is a living being. It too is a living being and exists within its own living world, the world of the sun and the planets and even the stars." Can you tell our listeners what you meant by that?
What I meant by that is something, I hope I communicated that in the book, is quite deep and very, very ancient idea. Not only the Earth is alive, but the whole universe is alive. The universe is like an immense organism with levels and degrees of purpose written into its very structure, from the galactic clusters in the universe to down to the microbes and within our own individual human bodies. And everything is alive. Therefore, everything is growing or dying one way or the other. And it is, everything is moving to fulfill its purpose or losing its purpose, and therefore will be discarded or perish. And it goes true of the Earth, and it's true of humanity. And our growing and evolution is now a question of a conscious evolution. Human evolution, the next step in our development, can't take place mechanically as some evolutionary processes perhaps do. It requires the human beings a spiritual effort, self-knowledge, self-understanding. The Earth needs our awareness to survive as the Earth and to develop. And if it does not develop like everything else, it will go the opposite way. And in my book, I hope, is simply a call to open that question in our lives, because we are so, and rightfully, we're so concerned about the environmental effects of the pollution, et cetera, that we don't realize that there's another kind of development, an inner development that is needed at least as much, if not even more so, than the environmental corrections we are planning.
If people raise the level of their consciousness, how will that help to solve the physical real-world problems like global warming, for example?
One way, certainly, is that human development, evolution, means not just development of a bigger brain or something. It means the development of the maturing of the emotional or feeling quality in our being, in ourselves. And morality right action. It depends on morality. Morality depends on feeling the truth, feeling what is good in a deep enough way so that it influences our action. We all sort of know what's true, what's good, but we also see that our actions betray it almost all the time, especially on these big scale of worldwide issues. Our knowledge, our scientific development, our intellectual knowledge has far, far exceeded our moral power to live in the right relationship to what we know. And so our evolution will be a moral evolution, not just a mental evolution. Therefore, that development may actually give us the moral power to act on what we know to be good, whereas now it's very, very difficult and tricky. That's certainly one way. And another way, though, it's much more unusual for people to think about, is that there might maybe some kind of invisible, undetectable influence of consciousness itself on the needs of the earth. Just as when we have in our own minds an awareness of our body, the body begins to respond in a much more positive way and changes and develops just because our attention is flooding the body. Attention is a very sacred, positive, actual material force that causes our organism to develop. Similarly, the development of the attention, the conscious mind of humanity, to some small extent even, could be the tipping point toward a very positive effect in the development of the earth. And the earth may need the existence of a developed consciousness, not only because of the action it would enable us to perform, but in it for itself as a kind of energetic influence on the future of the planet.
I'd like to read just a couple little excerpts out of the book and have you tell our listeners what you were intending by making these statements. For example, you say, "In not seeing the possibility of higher consciousness in man, science was also blind to the existence of higher, deeper levels of laws and purpose in the physical universe." And you make a connection in the book between what you call scientism, with a literal reading of the scientific worldview, between that and the fundamentalist reading of the sacred texts in each religious tradition. So I'm wondering if you can elaborate on how you see all that.
Well, yes, because the great ancient idea that nature is the signature of God, and like scripture, who cannot really understand scripture, sacred writings, and this I've learned over the years teaching this material in courses on religion, but scripture requires the head and the heart both together to understand its inner meanings, its symbolic meanings, not just its literal meanings. And you need both, because real deep feeling is an instrument of knowing. We don't think that in this modern world, because we think all knowledge has to be mental only, and we have to discard emotions when we come to know things. But that's true maybe of certain familiar egoistic emotions. But behind those egoistic emotions, hidden from view almost, is a deeper level of feeling, which is a source of knowing. And the head and the heart have to be brought together to understand scripture, in the same way that head and the heart need to be brought together in order to understand the signature, the scripture of the universe itself, of nature itself. So in that sense, science gives us a fantastically complete, powerful, literal reading of the book of God. That's a word, literal reading of nature itself. So we need to read the book of nature not only to make products and achieve wonderful goals and disease and things of sort, but we also need to read it with the heart in order to know our purpose, which means to become morally powerful beings, which we are not now. And that's what I hope the reader will feel, a sense, a little glimpse of the mysterious and wonderful fusion of hope and duty. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, and we really appreciate your talking with us.
Thank you, Chuck, for your good questions.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you, Chuck Scherr, regular host of KRCB's Jazz Connections, which you can hear every Saturday from 8 to midnight. Find out more about Jacob Needleman at jacobneedleman.com. Finally, Barbara Quick, author of Vivaldi's Virgins and The Golden Web, among others, brings us her review of Cheryl Strayed's memoir, Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail.
I'm truly in awe of Cheryl Strayed, author of Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail. This best-selling, Oprah-picked, heartbreaking, laugh-out-loud memoir deserves every word of praise it's garnering. Also known as the kick-ass internet advice columnist Dear Sugar, Cheryl Strayed is one of the most luminously honest and emotionally generous writers I've ever encountered. Growing up poor, abandoned by an abusive father, the author was nonetheless graced by a mother who loved her children unstintingly, managing to give them lofty goals and a moral compass despite the chaos of their lives. When her mother was diagnosed with cancer and died within the space of several months, the 22-year-old budding author went to pieces. Strayed invented the aptness of her pen name in the years immediately following her mother's death. She mired herself and her young, beloved husband in an obsessive binge of sluttiness. She started using heroin. She did everything she could to screw up her life now that her mother was no longer in this world. She saved herself and nearly killed herself in the process by undertaking an epic backpacking journey. Getting hodgepodge advice from sales clerks at REI and squirreling away the tips she got as a waitress, she outfitted herself for a solo trip of 1,100 miles from the parched peaks of the Mojave Desert to the snowdrifts of the Washington-Oregon border. In her ignorance and enthusiasm, Strayed prepared a pack that was too heavy for her to move, to say nothing of hoisting it onto her back and schlepping it for over 1,000 miles. Fortunately for us, the author took the time and care to distill her experience over the space of 20 years, all the while honing her craft as a writer and healing the hole in her heart. There's one basic message in Wild, and in all the Dear Sugar columns as well, that every single one of us has a great big hole in our heart. And our job, if we're brave and true, is to hoist our wounds up on our backs and carry them with us through life as gracefully as we can, even if we're staggering under their weight. In this perilous season of forced good cheer and hopes for comfort and joy spun out of our greatest vulnerabilities, Wild is a welcome tribute to our weakness and wounds. This is Barbara Quick for A Novel Idea.
You can learn more about Barbara at barbaraquick.com. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you'll come back again. Our shows are archived at krcb.org/podcasts, or just Google us. You can also subscribe to our podcasts and listen through iTunes. I'm Suzanne Lang. You've been listening to KRCB's A Novel Idea.